Audio book made for private listening, of book from 100 years ago, Demon Lover, by Dion Fortune. Short intro. The Demon Lover. Fortune's first attempt at a novel per se is a much more interesting affair from a literary point of view. She avoids the mistake of the previous book of having the stories told from the position of the non-psychic, by making sure that the viewpoint character gets to participate in and observe in the phenomena which underlie the plot. Moreover, it has a plot to engage the interest. A classic horror story, which could easily be adapted into a film comparable with, for example, The Exorcist. A sinister black magician plans to cynically use an innocent young girl as part of a magical war against his occult lodge. However, despite the fact that he could easily have sacrificed her when his plan is discovered, he has an attack of conscience, he is falling in love with her, and incurs the supernatural wrath of the lodge on himself. However, because he cannot completely renounce his evil ways, he eventually pays a terrible price for what he has done. There is a similarity in subject matter. For example, Fortune reworks the vampire idea of Tavernor, but does so in a manner which is more reminiscent of a conventional horror story. Indeed, throughout the work she seems now to be displaying the sensibilities of a novelist, as opposed to an initiate playing at being one. We also have some indication of Dion beginning to display her independence of thought. Lucas, the demon lover of the title, is unquestionably evil, but the lodge against which he intrigues does not provoke our sympathy, as it is painted as full of old men, stuck in the mud, convinced of their own self-righteousness. The resolution of the novel proposes that it is only through the intervention of the pure young heroine, who can use her femininity to restore the balance of the moribund lodge, which can save all parties concerned. This heroine turns out to be the reincarnation of Lucas' lover in a previous life. And note, that the heroine defies the strict regime of the lodge, but is backed up by a higher power, a high adept who seems to be a member of the Third Order. Chapter 1. The back of one of the massive, old-fashioned houses in a Bloomsbury square was a single-storied structure originally intended by the architect for a billiard room. It was connected with the main building by a short passage, and its windowless walls supported a domed roof of glass. The present users of the room, however, were apparently engaged in some matter which did not require a good top light, for a ceiling had been built across the span of the dome, and save for the steady purring of an electric fan behind the louver boards of the lantern, no sign of life was apparent from the outside. The windowless walls and double roofing rendering the building light and soundproof. This suited admirably the purposes of its present users, whose work required absolute immunity from any sudden sound or change of light, and who had no wish to draw the attention of the neighbors to their proceedings. Although the night was a sultry one, the group of men seated round the table seemed to suffer no inconvenience. The faces varied greatly in type. The chairman of the meeting had the air of a prosperous businessman. On his right was an unmistakable lawyer, on his left, a benign old gentleman with a long white beard, next to him, a mechanic of the better class, opposite was a journalist. At the foot of the table, however, there sat a man who could not so readily be assigned to a place. He might have been a diplomat, he might have been a detective, or he might have been one of those pseudo-aristocratic adventurers who hang upon the fringe of smart society. With the exception of the mechanic, he was the youngest man present, and the minutes book in front of him marked him as the secretary of the meeting. Though the members were of such divergent types, they had certain characteristics which marked them as men whom some common discipline had welded together. Each possessed the power of sitting absolutely motionless unless he had occasion to move. A far from common accomplishment, each radiated a peculiar sense of poise and power, and each, with the exception of the secretary, had a pair of absolutely expressionless eyes, and even his did not respond to emotion as eyes generally do, by alteration of the muscles round the sockets, but marked his feelings by an expansion and contraction of the pupil itself, which produced an extraordinary effect upon the observer. The eyes, of a very dark hazel with greenish lights in them, together with the sallowness of the skin, gave an unpleasing impression which, in some way, the perfect regularity of the features intensified. It was the face of a man who might be exceedingly interesting, exceedingly charming, and exceedingly unscrupulous. The meeting, proceeding quietly with the transaction of business, was redeemed from ordinariness by the fact that the seventh member lay asleep on a couch, no one taking the slightest notice of him except the secretary, who cast quick, sidelong glances in his direction in the intervals of note-taking, and seemed prepared to spring up and catch him should he show any signs of rolling onto the floor. The discussion of business was carried on quietly, almost in undertones, accounts for large sums of money being brought forward and passed without comment, when a peculiar sound broke the stillness of the room. From the figure on the couch came a long drawn-out sibilant hiss. No notice of this strange manifestation was taken by any person present except the secretary, who put a cross on the top of the pad on which he was taking notes. A short while passed, during which the committee still worked in hushed voices, and then a second prolonged hiss came from the sleeper, and the secretary made a second cross on his writing pad. A third and fourth hiss followed in quick succession, and successive crosses were added to the row at the top of the secretary's tablet. On the completion of the fourth he looked up as if anticipating a command. For the first time the other members of the committee glanced at the sleeping figure. "If he is sufficiently deep in trance," said the chairman, "we will put aside the accounts and proceed with the houseman problem." "He is on the fourth hypnoidal level," said the secretary. "That will do," was the answer, and with cautious movements the committee disposed itself so that the hitherto ignored seventh member became the focus of attention. The secretary stretched out a thin brown hand and tilted the shade of the lamp so that the sleeper's face was thrown into still deeper shadow, then he left his chair and went and sat on the couch beside the recumbent man, who never stirred, leaning forward. He tapped a certain spot on the unconscious head with a peculiar rhythm. Immediately, without stirring a muscle of his face, the sleeper emitted the most extraordinary sound that ever issued from a human throat. It could only be compared to the weird noises that arise from a faulty gramophone, and then the secretary proceeded in as calm and matter-of-fact manner as if he were using an ordinary telephone, to ask for a number, using the unconscious man as a means of communication. 50 North, 14 East, he repeated several times, as if seeking to call up some invisible exchange. After a few repetitions the sleeping man replied in the German language, asking his interrogator who was calling. 30, naught, replied the secretary. "Is that the Prague Lodge?" "It is," replied the sleeper, speaking in English, with a slight foreign accent. "We want particulars of Brother Hermann Hausmann, a German-American, last heard of at Prague, who is suspected of attempting to negotiate with the Vatican for the sale of information concerning the Brotherhood's policy in regard to the French situation. He left here early in May for Switzerland." "Try the Geneva Lodge," replied the sleeper. Again the secretary repeated his tapping, and again the peculiar note, halfway between the hoot of an owl and a telephone bell, was heard. 46 North, 6 East, said the secretary, and the sleeping man replied in French this time, asking again who called. 30, naught, replied the secretary again, and again inquired of the sleeper for news of Hermann Hausmann, and was informed that he had left Geneva at the end of May and proceeded to Naples and thence to New York. Yet once more the secretary repeated his tapping, and elicited the same peculiar sound from the sleeper. 40, north, 74 West, he repeated several times, and finally a voice with a strong American accent replied. News of Hermann Hausmann was again demanded, and this time obtained. "He came here early in June by the White Star Liner," said Rick, "and got in touch with the Tammany bosses. We sent him a summons to attend Lodge, and he got in a panic and started west. Then it was decided to send him an order of execution by means of the dark ray of destruction." The men round the table stirred uneasily and looked at one another. "With what results?" asked the interrogator. "He stopped off at Buffalo, took the cars to Niagara, and went over the suspension bridge." "Over into Canada?" "No, over into the river," replied the sleeper, his expressionless countenance strangely contradicted by the challenging note in his voice. The men in the dim-lit room looked at each other. The mechanic covered his mouth with his hand to hide a nervous smile, the journalist shrugged his shoulders, the lawyer fidgeted with pens and paper, and the pupils of the secretary's eyes opened and shut like those of a cat. It was the patriarch on the chairman's left who broke the silence. "I don't like it," he said. "I don't like it at all. I cannot approve of these methods. For God's sake, let us leave the issue to higher intelligences than ours, and not take the law into our own hands. There is a spirit growing up in the fraternity," said the chairman, in a deep, booming voice, which can lead to nothing but disaster, and he glared at the secretary as if he were responsible for the American's death. The pupils of the secretary's peculiar eyes completely disappeared, and the irises filled with green gleams like the fire in a black opal, but it was the journalist who took up the defense. "This is no time for half measures," he said. "Be sure your policy is right, and then go ahead and make a clean job of it. Look at the difference in our position since the new spirit came into the fraternity. From being a group of antiquarians, we have become a factor to be reckoned with in international politics." One after another they spoke with considerable feeling, but the secretary kept silence. He, although he was never directly addressed, seemed to be regarded by the others as responsible for the new spirit. Finally, each having said his say, silence fell upon the men round the table. The secretary raised his peculiar eyes to the chairman. "Shall I bring him round?" he inquired. The chairman nodded glumly. The brown hand of the secretary passed swiftly across the face of the sleeper with a peculiar snatching movement several times repeated, who thereupon stirred slightly and snuggled down into the cushions. It was apparent, however, that the death-like passivity had given place to natural sleep. In a minute or two he stirred again, roused, sat up, and blinked dazedly at the lamp. The secretary poured a cup of steaming coffee from a vacuum flask and handed it to him, for close though the night was, the man was shivering with cold. The hot drink speedily restored him to his normal consciousness, and he inquired whether any news had been obtained of Herman Houseman, and the words that had issued from his lips were repeated to him. At the news of the suicide he gave a long whistle and stared hard at the secretary. Presently the meeting broke up, the members departing in twos and threes. At the door each of these sober-minded men of the world did a peculiar thing. They turned and genuflected as if leaving a church, for in the shadows in the far end of the room the dim outline of an altar could be discerned on which red light was burning. Among the last to leave was the old man with the long white beard. Pausing before the secretary, he held out his corded old hand. After an almost imperceptible hesitation, the thin brown fingers were placed in it. "Lucas," said the old man, "no one appreciates more than I do what your work has meant to the fraternity, but I hope to God you will never want anything you ought not to have." Left alone, the secretary switched off the electric fan and silence shut down upon the room like a thing palpable. He paused for a moment with his hand on the switch, as if uncertain what to do next, then he crossed over to the table and stood looking down at the scattered papers, but made no movement to gather them up. He was evidently deep in thought, going over in his mind the events of the evening and trying to interpret their significance. It had been quite evident that he was not in good odor. Even his supporters had been apologists and his opponents had been among the weightiest members of the fraternity, and the evening's proceedings had served to bring to the surface a dissatisfaction that had been smoldering for some time. Lucas's doings were not liked, so much had been made quite clear to him, and if his doings were not liked, then he must be prepared to mend his ways or there would be serious trouble, for, as most people are aware, it is one thing to get into an occult fraternity, but quite another to get out of it. He knew his chiefs, men of the highest ideals, but also of the sternest justice, and he knew that rebellion need expect no mercy. First would come an order to attend lodge and offer an explanation. Should that prove unsatisfactory, he would be commanded to return to the archives all insignia, symbols and manuscripts, and he would be solemnly warned, in a formula thousands of years old, that for the future he would exercise occult powers at his peril. And then he would be bidden to go forth and associate no more with his brethren. Should he, however, persist in his evil ways, should he, especially, pervert to his own ends the powers he had acquired, then something that was not of this plane of existence dealt with him. No man raised a finger against him. The law was not invoked. His name was not mentioned for evil, but, all the same, something happened to him, and after that which was to fall had fallen, he was incapable of either good or evil for the short span of existence which usually remained to him. Lucas knew all this quite well, and, hands deep in trouser pockets, he slowly paced the room, calculating his chances of escape should he decide on the course of defiance. 6 years ago, with a promising journalistic career before him, he had suddenly abandoned Fleet Street, and to the surprise and disgust of his colleagues, become secretary to a society for the study of comparative folklore. Why he did it, they could not make out, and Lucas did not enlighten them, but, if the truth were known, he was controlling the mundane piedeter that even the most esoteric of occult fraternities must have, and to this fraternity he dedicated his existence. As had been truly said that evening, he had raised the fraternity to a very different position to that which it had occupied when first he took its affairs in hand. He had found it engaged in study for study's sake, and he had shown it the practical application of its knowledge. Hitherto it had contented itself in dealing with the individual, his development or regeneration. Lucas showed it that its methods were equally applicable to international affairs, and he had interfered with such notable success in certain coups d'état that the great majority of his fraternity looked upon him as the coming leader. It was only a minority that viewed his doings askance, but, as he had seen that evening, the seniors of the fraternity were in that minority to a man, and it was they alone who could bind or loose. It was useless to have the support of numbers if those who held the keys of power closed the door upon him. And it had been borne in upon Lucas recently that these doors were closed, had, in fact, been closed for some time. He had realized that no amount of hard work, no amount of devotion, would take a man up the fraternity if that man's heart were not right. Lip service would not avail, either. The trained clairvoyants who had charge of these matters judged a man neither by what he said nor what he did, but by the colors of his aura. And that telltale emanation revealed the truth. No amount of ostentatious church going on Sundays and wearing of crosses on watch chains could conceal the dull red glow that Saturday night's diversions left behind, or counterfeit the bright clear electric blue that had to show before a man was judged fit for the higher degrees. Lucas knew that although his aura showed the occult green, that green was not right, and he could not get it right except by changing his whole nature. By casting out the inordinate ambition and love of power that consumed him and bringing in compassion for his fellow men, and neither of these things could Lucas see his way to achieve. He despised his fellow man too much to feel anything beyond a contemptuous pity for him, and as for foregoing the fruits of power, what else was there to live and strive for? He was quite willing to show kindness to all and sundry, or any other manifestation in fact that might be demanded of him as a qualification. But laboriously to acquire power and then to refrain from using it for one's own benefit even when driven into a corner, this was beyond his comprehension. He was prepared to pay any price required for his apprenticeship. He had worked as Jacob worked for Rachel, but for 2 years his progress had been held up, and men with half his capacities had preceded him into the higher degrees. His theoretical studies completed, he realized that the chiefs had no intention of entrusting him with the practical applications thereof. The secret science of the hidden forces of man and nature he knew, but not the names of power by which these forces were controlled, and without them all his studies were useless. He had a lock, but not the key. And so he paced up and down, pondering his problem. The chiefs had openly declared their dissatisfaction. A complete revision of the fraternity's policy might follow, and with it a drastic clipping of his own wings. He might even be removed from the post of secretary. For this contingency he had endeavored to provide. Next door lived an aged general, gasping his life out in repeated attacks of bronchitis, any one of which might prove fatal. Lucas had judiciously cultivated his acquaintance, and the first use he had made of his Delta degree initiation was to use the powers it conferred to cause the old man to make a will in his favor, so Lucas hoped before long to find himself among the landed gentry and the possessor of private means, in which situation he thought it might be easier for him to come up to the moral standard of the fraternity and obtain the coveted higher degrees. His only danger was that the will might be contested and the transaction thus brought to the ears of his chiefs, and what they would have to say on the subject would not be pleasant hearing, for he knew full well the white occultist's horror of black magic, and his drastic methods of dealing with it, and he supposed they would consider his transactions very black indeed, though he had no intention whatever of doing harm with the money, which would, he thought, be used to much better advantage if it were in his hands than distributed among the generaless nephews and nieces of the third and fourth generation. All the same, Lucas had a very wholesome fear of the dark force which almost invariably got the man, sooner or later, who deviated from the right-hand path. Some, indeed, but not many, had hidden immunity, but they were men who had climbed so high before they turned to the left that they were senior to those who had to deal with them and often, in fact, returned the occult onslaughts in kind, but these favored individuals were rare. Few men maintained themselves long when the fraternity moved against them. So Lucas calculated his prospects, and they did not look to him very promising unless he could get hold of those words of power that should enable him to fight at least on a level footing. That evening had shown him clearly that the fraternity would not give them to him. How, in the name of heaven, earth, and the waters under the earth could those carefully guarded secrets be obtained? Lucas's stride lengthened and quickened as his perplexity increased. Gazing before him with unseeing eyes, he swung like a pendulum up and down the room. Suddenly his progress was arrested. His blind march had gradually edged him across the floor till he ran into the low couch upon which the man who had served as the receiver of the occult telephone had lain. He stood staring down at it as if the sleeper still lay there, and through those entranced lips might come the solution of his problem. And come it did. With a sudden start Lucas realized that anyone who could go into a sufficiently deep trance could listen in at the occult ceremonies and learn the words of power, provided he cared to take the risk. Lucas had nerves of steel as an occultist needs to have, but even he did not care about that risk. Still he stood looking down at that couch, seeking further inspiration from a source that had already proved so fruitful. Supposing he could get at Spencer, and get him to join him in this raid upon the secrets of the fraternity. But he dismissed the idea. The brethren were all picked men, hard to corrupt by either threats or promises. Besides, Spencer would not like the risk any more than he did, but the idea in itself was good. Supposing he could find a trans medium who did not know enough to be scared, he could have his own occult telephone and listen in with impunity. The powers might strafe the medium, but they would find it exceedingly difficult to locate the man who was operating the medium. Lucas thoughtfully gathered up the papers, put the lights out, and went to bed. Chapter 2. When a school breaks up for the summer holidays, it is usual for the pupils to go their various ways to the country or seaside. All are not so happily placed, however, and the pupil who stepped out of the dark entry of the business training college into the blazing sunshine was engaged upon the urgent quest of fresh work now that her secretarial course was finished. Only the most rigorous self-denial had enabled her to get through her training. The third term had been one of semi-starvation, and this, added to the strain of the final examinations, had reduced her to an abnormal state in which she floated rather than walked, and saw grey ghosts about her instead of men and women. In her hand she grasped an envelope bearing an address in a neighbouring square, and containing an account of her attainments and credentials, and in her heart was annoying anxiety as to what she should do if she failed to obtain the prospective post. Three other girls joined her on the sunlit pavement, also bearing envelopes, and demanded of her destination, which proved to be the same as her own, and her heart sank still further when she realized that there was going to be competition for the coveted work, And into her mind there flashed a vision of her own face as she had seen it in the dressing room glass while pinning on her hat, white and exhausted, with deep lines under the eyes and dark circles round them, and it seemed to her that, were she herself engaging a secretary, Veronica Mannering would not be her choice. The others chattered gaily on their way to the square. They did not care much whether they got the post or not, they were only looking at it in case it were so well worth taking as to counterbalance the loss of a summer holiday, and they made it quite plain to Veronica that it had to be very good to be accepted by them at that time of year. She, for her part, had determined to accept anyone who would have her, rather than be disengaged in the blank emptiness of a London summer. They were admitted through large double doors by an impassive butler, and ushered into a room, which was obviously a waiting room rather than one that was lived in. Veronica, in her abnormal, almost dream state, felt as if the spirit of the place was audible to her inner consciousness. The butler did not seem to her to be an ordinary butler, but rather a lay brother of some sort of fraternity. She wondered whether the immaculate shirt front concealed a great cross that hung from his neck by a chain, or was it the symbol of some strange pagan worship he wore. She felt certain that the carefully pomaded strands of hair disposed at regular intervals across the top of his bald head rested upon a store of knowledge such as is not usually confined under a butler's skull. The atmosphere of the room, while full of strange, almost electrical vibrations, was brooded over by a great peace, wonderfully soothing to the girl's overwrought nerves. A longing to remain in the stillness overwhelmed her. But she feared greatly lest the coveted post were not for her, for half the secretarial agencies of London appeared to have sent candidates of all shapes, sizes and descriptions. Suddenly the door opened and a man stood on the threshold surveying the assembly. Of medium height and lightly built, he moved with a springy alertness that put Veronica in mind of a stag, as if he could be off and away at full speed in the flash of a second. Deliberately and entirely impersonally, he inspected the waiting women one by one. Finally, Veronica's turn came for a scrutiny. The man's eyes met hers with a normal, observant, not unsympathetic glance, and then, all of a sudden, changed to an expression of ferocious intensity, and yet he did not appear to see her at all, but, on the contrary, to be looking straight through her. A second later, he resumed his normal expression. And for the first time since entering the room, he spoke. "If you will come to my office," he said, "I should like to have a talk with you." Veronica followed him out of the room into the one immediately behind it. It was a large, pleasant room, furnished not as an office, but as a sitting room, and surrounded by bookcases. A faint, sweet smell, as if incense were habitually burnt there, hung in the air. The door of a strong room, and a desk in the window, were the sole indications that it was used for business purposes. The man seated himself at the desk and motioned her to a chair opposite. "My name is Lucas," he said. "What is yours?" She told him, and with shaking fingers handed him her training certificate, which he accepted, but neglected to remove from its envelope. "How old are you?" was the next question. 23, said Veronica. "What did you do previous to your training?" She told him how she had cared for her widowed mother till the latter's death terminated the little pension upon which they had both subsisted, and then how the minute savings had just served to launch her upon the world. "Have you good health?" he inquired. "In the ordinary way, that is, when you are not overworked. Have you had any serious illnesses?" She was able to give satisfactory answers to both these questions. "I think you will do," said the man. "What salary do you want?" Veronica had had so little hope of obtaining the post that she had not thought about the salary, and almost at random, stated the sum that one of her companions had remarked would be necessary to secure her own services, and then her heart stood still lest she had demanded too much and would be rejected, but the man in the revolving chair did not seem disconcerted. He nodded his head. "We will see how it works," he said. "Now when can you start?" Veronica's aid that she was disengaged and could start forthwith. "That will suit me very well," he said. "There is no occasion for delay. If we are going to begin, we may as well begin at once. You will have a couple of rooms upstairs placed at your disposal. I live in the house myself. But that need not trouble you, you will never see me except during business hours. Various other men come and go. I don't know whether you will consider the butler's wife an adequate chaperone, but she is the best we can offer you.